I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey guys, guess what? I'm so excited because this episode of Adulting is brought to you by Time of the Month Organic. They're the guys that sent me my menstrual cup. If you follow me on Instagram, I'm sure you'll know what I'm talking about. If you don't, you can find them at TOTM Organic on Instagram. And basically, they sell eco-friendly, vegan, cruelty-free, organic cotton tampons. I know that sounds like my really long order at Starbucks. And they sell reusable menstrual cups. If you follow me on Instagram, you will know that I am completely converted and love it. Anyway, I'm going to talk a little bit more later on in the podcast. I hope you enjoyed the episode and thanks again to Time of the Month. And welcome to Adulting. This is the podcast where we discuss that time in your life where you don't really necessarily know what's going on, but you think that you're supposed to know. And today I have a very exciting guest with me. He's been very elusive, very hard to get, but I finally got him. It's Henry Fraser.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
No, you're more than welcome. Thanks so much for coming. Well, actually, I came to you. It's lovely. But yeah, so Henry Fraser is a really inspirational guy, and you might know him from his book, which is out, called The Little Big Things. And you might have seen him on Instagram. He does really inspirational mouth paintings, which are incredible. Do you want to explain a little bit of how this came about, like why you wrote this book? And
Well, I had an accident back in July 2009. When I was on the beach one day, me and my mates had a kind of lads' holiday abroad. We went to Portugal for a week. Then one day we were just playing muck around on the beach, as I had done kind of the few previous days before. Kind of chucking a rugby ball around, kicking a football around, and I decided to go run to the sea and cool off. I mean, I'd done the exact same thing earlier that day, but this time I ran into different parts of the sea off the beach, dived forward from where I thought the seabed would carry on dipping down, getting deeper, but turned out there was just kind of a sandbank in the way, and I dived forward, gone head first straight into the sandbank and dislocated my neck. And from that moment on, I was paralysed from the neck down. I was kind of just left there floating in the sea, kind of worried for my life, really. I mean, I thought at that point I was going to die. Mm. Very lucky, I had two friends who close by who I'd followed into the water. They're to one side. They asked me if I was okay. I managed to barely get my mouth out of the water and say no. They dragged me out of the water. And then from that moment, I was taken to hospital and had surgeries on my neck, had all kinds of illnesses and other ailments and trucks beyond belief and surgery to screw and wire the vertebrae back into place, pacemaker because my heart kept stopping and all these things. Mm. And then a few weeks there, came back to England, 6 months in hospital in England, trying to kind of get myself as fit and healthy as possible and try and push myself. And that's what the book's about, really. And then the years between that happening and the book, before I even started the book, I never thought in my life I'd ever write a book. I've never been the biggest reader. I've never thought about sharing my story in that way. But someone asked me if I wanted to share my story and my experiences. And I just thought, why not? I'll give it a go, see what happens. And yeah, it's kind of been a bit mad, the whole thing. It's all, I don't know, way more than I ever expected.
But I think that's because your reaction or the way that you've dealt with the situation is more than anyone could expect. Like, when I was reading the book, it's so overwhelming. I mean, for anyone nowadays, we all talk about mental health so at the forefront, and everyone in kind of any position has days where they're like, I'm finding this really hard. But when you read the book, like, I honestly read it and I couldn't explain. It's so, well, I was saying, I was emailing Henry, like, swearing, like, you're effing amazing. Because I just can't explain how overwhelming and grounding it is to read someone who's been through something which, in any situation, is going to be probably one of the most difficult things anyone could face.
And it's just your outlook and your positivity. And obviously, I'm sure that there was times when it was really, really difficult. But, I mean, everyone, you need to read the books. Anyway, The List of Big Things, very, very good. But it's just the way that you've now completely changed your outlook on life. And I actually, like, bookmarked little quotes that I even read now. There's stuff about when you, like, first have that drink of water, and I never really knew what it meant to be thirsty until I had that. And
yeah, well, I'd gone 5 weeks without eating or drinking a thing. So when I had those moments again, six, 7 weeks actually without eating or drinking. And you forget about those things. And when you have it, I was desperate for a drink all the time. But I wasn't allowed because my body, all the muscles in my neck and chest and everything, I wasn't allowed to swallow anything just in case it went down the wrong way and I'm not able to get it back up again and I can choke and all those kinds of things. So when I tasted it, I was like, this is the best thing. I've never really tasted it. Water and things that you just learn to grasp, those little moments, those things that give you a boost. That's one of the things I wanted to get across in the book. I didn't want to sugarcoat anything. I wanted to go as tell people how dark I was in my mind and how ill my health was and all these things. And because I wanted to kind of show that no matter what the circumstances, no matter what happens to us, we can still find positives in these situations. And sometimes you do have to go to those dark places to almost start from the bottom. Yeah. I speak about it in the book, kind of the toughest day I had, and it'll probably be the toughest day I ever have in my life, was when I was put into a wheelchair for the first time. And I think it was about nearly 2 months after the accident happened. And I was taken around the hospital and I was finally able to get up and see all the places my friends and my family had been talking about. And I thought, oh, that's fantastic. It's the best thing. We went outside. It was kind of mid-September. It's still warm. It went out, walked around the hospital, about to come through the main entrance of the hospital, which were these two big glass doors. And the first time in 2 months, I saw my reflection.
Mm.
And the last time I saw myself was probably before on the night out, the day before the accident. And before the accident, I was this fit and healthy 17-year-old boy. Kind of loved the gym. I was strong, I was healthy. And then I saw myself and I was in this big chair, this big headrest. So I couldn't support my own head, armrests. I was so thin, my clothes just hanging off me. I had the tracheotomy in my throat with an oxygen tank attached to it because I still couldn't breathe properly for myself. And like the world just froze around me.
Mm.
And I'd lost 4 stone at that point. I was so thin. And then I got back to my room, pulled the curtain around my bed, and I just cried and I cried. My mum was with me. I just wanted to be able to hug my mum. Yeah. I couldn't even hug my mum. And I was just crying. My brothers came to see me. I was crying. My dad came to see me after work. I was crying. And then he left. He was always last to leave. And I was on some pretty strong sleeping tablets at that time, but not even those could send me to sleep that night. And I kissed her about 3 or 4 in the morning, I was just crying. And then I just had this kind of moment where I just couldn't cry anymore. And I just generally just thought to myself, I was like, all right, I want no one to blame what's happened, I may as well just get on with it. And then from that moment, my whole mindset changed. Because I guess before that moment, I always had this kind of that denial in the back of my head of, oh, I'm going to be fine, I'm going to walk out of hospital. And yeah, before that point, I had found positive moments, but in my head, there's always that hint of denial. And this had just kind of the reality of the rest of my life had been shown to me in that reflection. And at that point, I just had to deal with it. There's no point trying to have those moments of denial. This is me, I need to get on with it. And then from that moment, I was able to write, I'm going to focus on all the things I can do, look at the right things, try and get rid of this ventilator full time, get rid of the oxygen tank, get rid of all those things, and just bit by bit, just build it up.
I say that like one of the things that I think is so positive about the book, just for everyone to understand, is I never really did realise if someone suffered from like paralysis or that kind of injury, the extent of all the other problems that you have coming off the back of that and how much you would have had to go through. Because to get from there to where you are now, I guess no one really sees into that space where...
No, and I mean, I never knew about it before my accident either. I like most people, when you see someone in a wheelchair, you just think, oh, they can't walk.
Yes.
But there are so many. There's just basic things. So from in many cervical injuries with the neck, my level not really. People are ventilated at the start because the lungs shut down. They won't work. So I had to retrain my lungs. Had to push my body, really try and get the working again. And being through all those things, you have to look after your skin because the skin's completely prone to pressure sores and breaking. And those things can set you back months and months. And I've been with people who had sores and they was then bedbound for 3 or 4 months. And things, the body, temperature control in the body completely goes. So you have to learn about that. Body gets too hot in the sun, so you can't be outside, too cold, the opposite way. So there's all these things. And I mean, there's still kind of things we're learning now, but it's kind of life. You just adapt to them, and everyone has little things they have to change too. Those are just mine.
Do you think in a weird way, like when you saw yourself and you realised that actually I am going to like be disabled, it gave you like more certainty than you'd ever had about like, I've got to make the most of everything kind of thing? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, before my accident, I mean, I took a lot for granted. I was very lucky. Me and my brothers were sent to very good schools. Mm. We were kind of in the best environments possible. We grew up and our parents given us kind of just a great life. And I guess I kind of coasted a lot of the time, and just because things came naturally, I never really had to push myself. And then suddenly when everything's taken away from you, yes, I've still got my family, yes, I've still got my friends, I've still got the people I love around me most of the time. But then suddenly I thought, if the accident was always going to happen in my life, if I go back and do all those things again, I would have put so much more effort into it. And there's a great quote I read once, and I can't remember who it was by, but someone said, it's not the things you do that you regret, it's the things that you don't do.
Yeah.
And I never really thought about that until recently. I think it's so true.
But by the same token, like you are, like you say that, but I think you're like, I never had to work for anything, but clearly your character and your resilience and who you are has enabled you to like deal with it. I'm sure that you know.
Oh, no, before the accident, I was very mentally very, very weak.
Really?
I used to just give up on a lot of things if I knew they wouldn't work. I wouldn't. If there was ever a chance of me failing at something, I'd rather not do it.
Yeah.
Then push myself and do it and fail and learn from it. I was just so scared. Those things, like, I used to get anxious about so many things and worry about everything.
Really?
Whereas now, it's kind of, I've had to put all my strength, I've had to kind of switch it all into my head and kind of complete reverse of how I was before. So now I'm so open to trying things, and doesn't work, that's fine. At least I know it doesn't work. I've done it. Just things like, public speaking used to terrify me more than anything else. I hated being in front of people.
I hate it right now.
No, not now. I was meant to say hated, but I don't know why I said hate.
I'm not giving him the worst time right now. He's like,
hey, you go away. I couldn't even get up in front of a class of 10 people and give a presentation. Mm. And now, I was given the opportunity a few years ago now to give a talk and share my story, and I just thought, why not? I'll give it a go. And I spent 6 months working on the best script for it. We worked very hard, and for the whole week before the first talk, I was a wreck. I wasn't talking to anyone in my family. I was talking to my friends. I was like, people just leave me alone, and like, I'm so nervous.
Oh no.
I could barely sleep. But then I did it, and I was like, this is brilliant. I really enjoyed it. And after the end, I kind of had this rush of it. And now public speaking is a big part of my life and being in front of people a lot. And it's like those things, like I just wish I'd tried it before, and why that? I just kind of think to myself, why didn't I do it? Why didn't I just
go for it? You don't want to regret that though, because for all you know, like it would have taken this to make you like live the best life.
That's why I always say kind of adversity has given me a gift. It's given me the chances to do all of these things. It's like I've been given a second chance.
But then by the same token, like, I can't even imagine how hard... It's so hard to broach it, because I want to be like, you're incredible, this is amazing. But then at the same time, I'm like, this is fucking difficult what you're dealing with. And, like, I'm sure it's still hard now, even though you're so positive.
No, I mean, now I'm kind of in a place where I've kind of guess I've got nothing to worry about.
Yeah.
I get to kind of the work I do, jobs that I want to be able to do. I've not been forced down one way or the other. I'm one of the kind of lucky people in this world that gets to say I really kind of love what I do. And it's one of these things that just happens, and it's just my life. I'm getting on with it and trying to live how everyone else lives theirs.
So in terms of like coming back to adulting, like when you were younger and the way that you looked at life, or like how you thought you grew up, and like now the way that you look at things, how has that changed?
I guess I've kind of learned I need to be a bit more organised and plan things. And whereas now I'm kind of, I've got a focus. When I do something, I really focus on it and make sure I'm going to do it. And like I said, I just try things and try and, if they don't work, then I can learn from it, and then I can just, how I progress with other things like art. If I do a painting, doesn't work, then I can go, all right, that doesn't work. Maybe if I try this, and it's just trying to make myself better at the things I'm currently doing.
Yeah.
Whether it be talks and learning from each talk and adjusting each time. If I spot a bit in the script that 2 weeks ago sounded good but now doesn't, so I'll change it. And it's just little things, and it is all little things that you need to keep adjusting and working on.
It seems like you've got really great patience, and also, like, especially talking about your art, like, even if you go back through, like, how your art's progressed and how incredible it is, and you just seem to have a real understanding of now, like, you just always seem to draw the positive out of things, which is what is so amazing, because it's really born out of, as you say, like, a hard time. But
yeah. See, I mean, trying to find, again, before the accident, I'd never find positives anywhere at all. And anything I did, I'd always be finding negatives. Whereas now it's kind of, there's no point ever looking at the negatives. I don't see the need for it. And it's only looking at those things is only destructive. It's never going to help you. It's never going to help anyone. Yes, spotting negatives and dealing with them and adapting to them, fine. But always dwelling on it, I just don't see the point. Whereas now, I always, no matter what I do, I would always try and find a positive.
Do you think it's rubbed off on people around you, like your friends and family?
I don't know. I think I was kind of probably the most negative out of probably anyone I knew.
But do you think your positivity now, because coming out from, like, when I read your book, there were certain bits, and I actually had to make notes on my phone that I was going to change certain things, because I just read certain things that really gave me such a good perspective, and I was like, right, I'm not going to do X, Y, Z anymore. And I'm sure that people have read your book and had that same response. And there's also a bit where you're like, I also don't want people to think that I'm writing this, like, I don't want you to feel sorry for me, I'm not saying this, I'm saying you need to realise where the good is in everything, which is an amazing point of view.
I guess because I'm around friends and family all the time, maybe they have, but maybe I just don't see it because I'm just with them.
You're just always imparting wisdom.
Never, ever. No. But I don't know. Maybe it has. I've kind of never really spoke to my friends about how they've kind of reacted to these things. Yes, they've told me about certain things, but I guess we just kind of got on with things as normal, I guess, how we were before the accident. Yes, kind of when I was with my friends at the start, it was very emotional. We cried a lot together, but now we're just as kind of stupid as we ever were when we're in a group. I guess some things never change.
That's enough to say, obviously, this is what we were talking about before. Like, it seems no matter how old you get, you always feel too young. Like, I still feel like I'm not an adult, or like I'm not ready to face certain things.
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, I'm 26 years old, and yes, I've kind of got a hold of kind of most of the things I'm doing, but still times I'm still like, I can't believe I'm 26. This is...
Yeah.
Still feel like I'm last years of school, my late teens, hanging out with my mates. But I guess that's quite a nice thing, though, at the same time. It's like these things are still normal, you're still able to have fun and enjoy yourself like you were when you were younger.
Yeah, I think maybe it's just you just feel as young all the time because you're always that age. I don't know if that makes sense. But it's when I feel old is when I'll try and make an excuse, and I'm like, oh, it's because I'm only 24, and I'm like, oh, shit, no, probably. I probably can't use that as an excuse anymore, which is really annoying. But looking forward, what about, so after all this, is there anything particularly that you, like, have a goal that you really want to achieve, or?
Good question. It's one of the things everyone always asks me, and because in the book and in my talks, there's a big bit where I talk about goals and goal setting. But at the moment, no, I guess the book took over my life more than I thought it would.
Were you overwhelmed by the response?
Oh, massively. Kind of the messages I've had from people like yourself and others have been, like, it's crazy. I'm kind of wrote the book not really expecting much. I guess so that at the same time, if stuff did happen, it would just feel that much better.
Yeah, I do that too. It's good.
Oh yeah, no, it makes things that much nicer. But I don't know, it's just at the moment I'm kind of catching up on all the art that kind of backed up whilst I was promoting the book.
And
I've got an exhibition coming up in September. So that's my next goal, and there are a couple of things that are kind of in the pipeline, but kind of unsure about them, but I don't know, maybe they'll come out next year.
When you were writing the book, like, was that a really enjoyable process? Did you think, actually, this is really cathartic, or...?
No, I mean, the cathartic release came when I wrote the first part of my story on my website.
Right.
Because I guess at that point I'd never really kind of spoken to anyone about what had happened. I think it was about 10 months after the accident happened. And at that point, for typing, I was using a kind of headset microphone. And so I was talking to the laptop and I was saying all this stuff out loud. And that was quite tough at times. Because at that point, of course, everything from the start was still fresh in my mind. But now, I mean, I enjoyed writing the book. It was quite interesting trying to get the whole narrative out of it and build a story and get the emotion.
But that's what's so cool, because you're not like, you didn't study writing or anything, and you've written it. It's like a really good, like, it's an amazing story in of itself. But then you've also, like you said, it's got a narrative and it's got.
I hated writing at school. I hated reading that because I only liked sport and I only liked the creative subjects. That was a big challenge, trying to switch my mind into writing mode. And but it was fun, and it was trying to get other people's side of the story as well. And all the bits that I missed, kind of the bits when I was stuck in bed and they were around the hospital and all these other things going on that I didn't get to see. So speaking to everyone else about it and then trying to edit it down. But I enjoyed it. I mean, the toughest bit was trying to get all the last details at the end, trying to get the front cover finalized.
Yeah.
I got to write the title and the chapter titles and paint the picture on the front.
Oh, that's so cool. I didn't even know that.
Yeah, so it's, so I enjoyed that. That was quite a fun process. But it takes longer, and it's kind of, everyone's got their own ideas. And luckily, the kind of head publisher I was working with, she was kind of on the same wavelength as me, so we managed to get what I wanted mostly. So
yeah,
it worked out well.
Grace,
yeah,
you know that I like love talking about periods.
I think everyone knows that.
Well, I was just wondering, because you've changed, haven't you, what you've been using as your sanitary product?
I absolutely have, and I'm so excited about it.
What have you been using?
So I got my period last week, and I was so excited for the first time ever. I got to switch to my menstrual cup, which I've been waiting to do for so long. I've been loving it.
Have you been? Because I've got we were on our periods at the same time. Yeah, we're literally as like always. Twins.
Yeah.
I love my menstrual cup. It's just cheaper, better. Because when we were in Venice, the best thing was I didn't have to take many tampons out with me. I just had my menstrual cup.
In general, I've been using the organic tampons because I literally had no idea about the difference between tampons. And obviously, I'm vegan as well. And I had no idea that obviously you just don't think of things like material things as not being vegan. So as soon as I found out about time of the month, I was so excited. Because if you think about it, you think about everything else you put into your body. And if you think about it, tampons spending a lot of time up in there.
Yeah, well, hopefully not too much.
No.
That is why I do like a menstrual cup, though, because you can actually leave it in for like 12 hours, I think, although I do change it on the rest.
It's better for the environment, it's better for you, and it's just so much easier.
It's so fab just having one thing. Like, I remember thinking that was so stressful. We had a really small clutch bag on a night out, and I'd literally have
like
to use
50 tampons.
Yeah, half the bag for all the tampons.
Yeah, and I'm not going to lie, as we know, I go through a tampon very fast, yeah. especially at the beginning of my period. So to have something like a menstrual cup that holds so much more yeah. periodicus.
And you can get different sizes depending on, like, if you've given birth or if you're under a certain age and you haven't had sex. We're size the second size. We're over.
Don't tell people I've had sex. I'm a virgin, thank you very much.
Sorry, I keep forgetting. Oh,
so do I.
Thanks so much for sharing your switch story with me.
That's okay, I'll share anything with you.
So in terms of, like, as well, within, like, I guess people who have been paralysed or in the disabled community, have you found that that this book has, like, helped people in those situations as well? Because I really don't think that a story like this has been in mainstream media really.
I've had a lot of messages from a lot of disabled people saying that it's kind of helped them and give them a different perspective. I mean, there are many people out there with stories like mine and people who think like me, but I was just lucky I was given the opportunity yeah. to present myself in a book, and I guess I was given I've been given a very kind of popular social media platform and following, and I guess it'd be irresponsible of me if I didn't use it in the right way and share the right stories and try and help others. And so yeah, I mean,
millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The response from everyone across all walks of life has been crazy.
I think irrespective of how you got to, like, do the book or whatever, it's so good that there finally is, and that you're, like, someone who's captured people's hearts and, like, they're really interested in you, because what that means is, as you say, it's going to give more representation for people who have suffered similar injuries to you or been through similar things, which wasn't there before. And I think that's, like, such a massive part of growing up and learning, is realising, like, seeing your privilege in certain situations. And so for me, like, to be able to speak to you and understand your story and for you bringing that to the limelight is going to have such positive repercussions.
Thank you.
For other people in the future, which is amazing.
Yeah, Wes, publisher, said, because I painted that painting
yeah.
of me on the beach probably about 2 weeks before we started talking about the front cover.
Was that from a photograph or from...
Yeah, so it was, I think it was 2016. We've got a house down in Dorset near the beach.
Nice.
We went down to the beach one day, and that was the first time I'd been on a beach since the accident, so it's 8 years later. 7 years after, sorry. And I asked my mum to take a photo of me on the beach, because obviously I wanted to just kind of have that moment. And then I decided to turn it into a painting. And it was published as saying it's one of the few books, one of the only books that actually has a wheelchair on the front cover.
Oh, wow.
I didn't know that at the time, but now that I know that, it's great, and it's great that they were willing and very happy to be part of that as well, and
yeah.
wanting to show that. And
that in itself is a massive thing, because I was even talking, I run a book club, and we were talking about yesterday about, like, understanding privilege and stuff, and to go, I had a friend who did the thing where she, like, had to try and get around the whole of London in a wheelchair, like, get to him from work. She was like, oh my God, it took me out. And she was like, I cannot believe how much we don't set up this world for people who have a disability.
Oh, no, it's shocking. Like, really, completely shocking. I mean, I get taxis. If I go out in London, I go out in London a lot with my mates. And if I do, I get a taxi in and out. And yeah, it's expensive. It costs a lot of money, but I'd rather spend that money than go through the hassle of getting trains. Because you can't turn up to a train station.
No.
You've got to call up. You've got to book. You've got to make sure someone's going to be there to help you assist, get you on and off the train, or use the ramps to get up the stairs and stuff. And it's like, you can't just go out and live a life yeah. like everyone else. And there's a tube map released recently of how many stations are accessible.
Yeah.
And the number is shockingly low. And even there's some of these stories about people turning up to stations and the lift's just not working, and they haven't been working for months and no one's done anything about it. It's like these people live trying to get to work just like everyone else, but they can't, and then people get stuck at home. And it's,
that's what I think is a really awful thing about it. It's one, like, it's so great that you're platforming that this story and that people got to know about it, but we need to make space for people with disabilities, because they're not a small number. There's so many people, and then, as you say, if we're not making this world, like, okay for people who aren't not just able-bodied people but disabled people as well, then it creates the idea that they can't just do whatever they want to do in life, which is a massive shame.
It is, and I mean, I don't want to get political about it, but the government are really screwing people hard, the people, disabled people, like, horribly so, and it's really, it's shocking, and it's absolutely disgusting what they're doing. But things like access and need to change, and change fast, because there's something, it's called the purple pound, the money that disabled people have to spend, that it's been kept out of the economy, and it's like billions, and it's like, why don't they just think, if they spend tens of millions sorting all this stuff out, give everyone the chance to live, get everyone the chance to get around, spend money in shops, get out, work, earn a living, and feel like they're part of society and contributing. And but there's so many barriers and holding thousands and thousands of people back.
There's a girl that came to my book club yesterday, and she has an autoimmune disease where sometimes her bones will be in, like, agonising pain, so she has to be in a wheelchair in those times. She went to go shop in a shopping mall that's open from 8 a.m. till 8 p.m. And you can get a wheelchair, you know, in this, but they only had that open from 11 a.m. till 3 p.m. She was like, so you're telling me as a disabled person I can only be within the mall? Also, who shops at those times? Like, that, they're the most antisocial hours. And it's this assumption that people with a disability can just function in, like, off-peak times or do things outside, which isn't fair and shouldn't be.
No, not at all. No, I completely agree. There's always seems to be an excuse that people have, but it just boils down to people just not caring or to just lying about stuff. It's even things just like toilet access. There's so many stories about people go to bars and restaurants and they go to use the disabled loo, and the disabled loo is just full. It's the restaurant or bar used as a storage area.
Yeah, I know, I've seen that.
And it's what are you doing? It just can't happen. Someone even said they're in a bar and restaurant recently, and the disabled loo is just brilliantly fitted out, great toilet, but was completely inaccessible to anyone, any disabled person. And it's like, what is the point of having that? And it's just because it ticks a box, and people would, lots of places will just do it to tick a box and say, we've covered it. Yeah, exactly. But no one thinks about the practicalities, no one, they always do these things and without kind of any involvement from a disabled person.
Well, this is the thing. I think what we've done is society does this. It's like dehumanized people with disability. It's like that we can't see. Whereas I think this is why your book is so important. Is you're like a young guy, and everyone can relate to you on another level apart from your disability. Mm. Like you're just anyone else, like anyone else. And the fact that you're someone out there with a story, doing really cool stuff, inspiring younger people, I think that's going to have a really positive impact on the way that people look and realize what a disabled person is, because it's just anyone else. It could happen to anyone.
Yeah.
And I think a massive thing that I want to do with this podcast as well is encourage people to start seeing outside of their sphere, and whether that comes to like fighting against sexism, fighting against racism, or fighting against ableism. All of those things are things that as we grow up we need to kind of check our privilege and, you know, platform. But are there any charities, or is there anything that is a good thing to champion if people want to create more disabled access or more disabled voices in spaces?
But there's a big one called it's called Transport for All.
Okay.
And it's a London-based kind of campaign page, or I think they're a charity, I'm not entirely sure, but they news on everything that's going on in London, all the and they run loads of campaigns and are actually campaigning a lot all the time, and they're brilliant, and they're the ones that are put up the tube map that I saw.
Okay, cool.
So I kind of, that's where I get a lot of my information from. And because I'm in London a lot, I just want to check. I'm not entirely sure about others around the country.
Yeah.
But there's another website called the Disability News Service, who cover everything about disability in this country and about
really
the government's treatment and about other people. And it's they're kind of my source of, kind of my oracle, basically, of everything I need to find out and share my views. And
oh, that's so cool. I might get them off you and we'll link them in the description box so people can look as well.
No, that'd be cool, because they're, I mean, I was kind of one of the people for Maxton, because I had no idea about disability until it happened. And I guess the more information we can give people, the more information you can share with everyone, is just, it's going to benefit everyone as well.
Yeah, and I think it's again, it's just down to this platform. We think the more we see it, the more we realise it's a problem. But because we don't provide for it, and then, like, how often do you see a disabled model or someone with a disability at the front of a campaign? I think it's happening more and more.
Yeah, no, there's lots of it happening, which is great, and but it is slow, and it's just things like TV presenters is a big one, and it bugs me. And it's starting to change a bit now, especially with Channel 4, very good at it. But most other channels only use disabled people to present shows about disability. But they also use able-bodied people to present shows about disability. But unless it's about disability, if it's just a normal program, you won't see a disabled person near it.
Yeah.
Channel 4 have changed it with the Tricks of the Restaurant Trade, and Sophie Morgan, she's in a wheelchair, she presents, and she's very good. But we just need to just give people the chances and just show that it is just normal. It's not it's not special. It's not to be treated like, oh, we feel sorry for them. It's just, we're just normal people.
I think
trying to live normal lives.
100%. I think the other problem with this is, like, when you're younger, you kind of get taught that you shouldn't look at someone if they have a disability. Do you remember being taught that, like, don't look kind of thing? And I think that's part of the problem, is that we think it's like, yeah, like you say, it's like special, it's like stigmatised. It shouldn't be like that. It should just be like, you're another guy and you happen to be in a wheelchair.
Yeah. It's like, I don't know if you saw it, The Silent Child.
No.
It was, I think it was nominated, maybe even won an Oscar for Best Short Film.
Mm.
And it was written by Rachel Shenton, an actress.
Okay.
I think she was in Hollyoaks, actually. And it's about a deaf girl whose family, she played this... Rachel Shenton plays a kind of social worker, comes in and trying to teach this girl sign language, and the family didn't want it. They thought the girl could survive off lip reading. But it's, and the actual deaf girl in it is a young deaf girl. She's in New Little Advert.
Oh, I think I've heard about it, but I haven't seen it. Yeah, carry on.
And she's brilliant in it. And it's, people just think, oh, they'll be fine with this, they'll be fine with that. Mm. They don't try and put themselves in the person's shoes and in their spot and how they feel and what they want to do. And it's about this young girl, she goes to school and the school will only try and build it off lip reading.
Mm.
And this young girl is kind of just completely isolated because she's got no one to talk to. No one knows, the school haven't set the school up to help her at all or for sign language or anything. And they bring up stats at the end and it's like 78% of schools aren't
equipped
for deaf children, and it's like, imagine being that child and you're just literally sat there not knowing anything that's going on, you're trying to lip read, but then you can't, someone's talking next to you, you have no idea what's going on, and it's shocking. At the end, it's very moving, actually, at the very end. But it's just things like that, you just think these shouldn't have to fight for these things. They should just be there. No, I agree.
And the problem is as well, because I don't have people with disability in power as well, so they're the ones that you don't have those voices or those people.
And that's the thing, all of the decisions about saving people's lives have been made by those who don't have a disability.
Right.
And it's like, these things, they just don't make sense.
No.
And it's, I mean, it's the same with gender, sexuality, race, all those things. They're We're all under the same umbrella. These things shouldn't be a thing. It's 2018. No. Like, we need to get over it and just, everyone seems to accept people are different, but we should all be treated equally. There shouldn't be.
Do you think having a disability, like, now this happened, do you think you view the world, like, really differently in terms of, like, where you see injustice? Are you, like?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, going back to Boy Accident, I grew up a very privileged life. Our parents always taught us to kind of accept people for who they are, like, just because someone's disabled or anything, you're like, why should we treat them differently?
Yeah.
There's kind of just no need for it. It's strange that people do.
Mm.
But now I'm in a position where I am kind of part of a group of people that are treated poorly and aren't given the same opportunities, and then I've suddenly realised, well, I've been given a platform, why don't I use it to champion people and champion campaigns to help people, and
yeah,
whether it be disability, gender, anything, like exactly. These things have to change.
Yeah.
At the moment in this world, people are willing to change, but still huge amounts and huge numbers of people that aren't, and it's sad. Like, this, people go out of their way to stop people from doing things, and it's, I just don't understand it.
No, it's really difficult. And it's hard, like, there's even things with, like, obviously invisible disabilities and stuff, but they're bringing out badges, I think, now, so you can get on the tube with it. It's a little blue badge, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the other thing, is people always assume disability is you have a wheelchair, you have some kind of giant aid to show people that you have a disability, and people don't understand, especially kind of a lot of muscular diseases and people like the girl you met with the autoimmune.
Yeah.
From the outside, you wouldn't see it, but then.
I have no idea.
But on the inside, their bodies will be hurting, their bodies will be struggling a lot of the time. And people will just like, well, you don't have a disability, I can't see it. And just never assume. Mm. Like, someone, lots of times, the stories of people who have a disability who parked in a disabled bay and they've got out of the car and people have shouted at them, like, why are you parking there? And it's like, just never assume.
No.
Never. If they've got a blue badge in the car, then they deserve to park there, no matter what.
Yeah.
No matter how they look, how they walk, how it's...
I just think we're not almost not taught about enough. Like, it's just the problem that the default person is, like, a healthy, fit, young, white man, normally. Like, there's no, you don't really see people of colour, you don't necessarily see people with disability. And I think, obviously, it's not your responsibility. I feel like now, Henry, you speak for all disabled people in the world. But, like, it is amazing that you've done this. Because I guess, as well, the other side of this could be that I think what happens with a lot of people with disability is it is a really difficult thing. The world doesn't seem to be ready for them in that they can't get transport, they can't do certain things. And so they do feel like, actually, I've just got to hide now.
Yeah, and lots of people do. They will just stay in their homes and they will isolate themselves from people, and it's a shame, and you shouldn't have to live your life like that. It's not their disability holding them back, it's other people, it's the government, it's businesses, it is individuals at times, and it's not themselves, it's not a choice, it's being forced upon them, and it just shouldn't be happening.
I feel like, so we don't really talk about too much sad stuff, but like on a more like positive side, you're obviously looking so much like, because as we're reading the book, you read through a journey and you face, I mean, I don't know how you did it. I always try and imagine, like, if I was in that situation, would I be able to do the things that you did? Like you say, like coming off the ventilator, challenging yourself, and you do like sit-ups and stuff now, and you look like fitter and stronger in yourself.
Yeah, well, I mean, kind of being in the gym, trying to get as strong and as fit as possible has always been something I love.
Yeah.
Yes, it's kind of not the same strength I had, not the same exercise I was doing, but it's the exact same challenge. It's trying to push my body to get the most out of it as I possibly can. And yes, I've only got very few working muscles, and those sit-ups I spoke about, that was an 8-year process to get to that point. It's been a long slog. I mean, the exercises that started at the beginning was just kind of hundreds of reps of physio, another physio, or my mum or one of my brothers move my arms for me, and then over time I just built it. And to anyone from the outside, those things may not seem like progress, but to me, no matter how small progress is, it's still
progress.
You're
still making progress.
Why not look at it in that way? And even if it's minimal, but I always looked at it as it was progress. I've improved, I've done better, I've done one more rep than last time, I've done a few hundred grams more weight than last time. And those make things make a massive difference to your mindset when you're trying to move on and progress. And and that's just how I looked at it. And I got the ventilator got off record time, tracheotomy I got in record time. And those are the goals I set myself, and I wanted to prove to... Never in my life, I guess, I'd never proved anyone wrong. I'd never pushed things to that point. And then in hostel, I wanted to do because I wanted to do things. A lot of the time in hostel, they just said everything. They just spoke about all the things I couldn't do.
Yeah.
And I wanted to show to them that I can do these things I want. And in hostel, a lot of the staff thought it was denial in me because they thought I wasn't accepting my situation. But I had. I just wanted to try and prove things.
What was it? Was it your physio or who was the lady that was amazing?
Ruth.
Ruth.
Yeah, she was awesome. She was incredible. And she's a massive part of my story.
Yeah. She sounds great. So for context, she's a physio, right? And she basically would encourage Henry to do lots of things at the hospital, like, oh no, you can't do them, and she didn't care. She believed in you because you believed in yourself, basically.
Yeah, and she didn't see me wanting to do more as denial. She saw it as, okay, you want to try and do it, and we'll do it. Never did she want to kind of give me false hope in anything. Mm. She saw that I wanted to try things, and she'd be trying to get me to try new things as well. And our whole mindset was, if it doesn't work, we'll try something else. But if it doesn't work that one time, doesn't mean it won't work later on. So yeah, we'll revisit it later. And those things are just those little tips that she was giving, and then we're like, okay, we'll take those and try them with these. Every other exercise I've done, we've always tried it. And whether it didn't work, we'll come back later. And the other thing she was saying is, in hostel, it's almost like a list of things.
Right.
By level of injury, what you can and can't do. And in hostel, it would be like, okay, if you can't do 1 and 2, you can't do 3 and 4. So we'll go back and keep trying 1 over and over again until something may happen. But her mindset, okay, if 1 and 2 didn't work, why not try 3? Why not try 4? Why not try all these things?
It's amazing.
All these, no one with, whether it's injuries, disability, no one across any form of disability really are like for like. It's very rare to find.
Yeah, do you think a little bit of that prejudice has seeped into the medical, the way that the world looks at it? It's like kind of like, well, you've got a disability, so do you know what I mean? Or do you think that's
a lot of I think a lot of stuff in hospitals and physios are kind of, the hands are tied a lot of the time, right, by health and safety.
Yeah.
And about, I just think at times they don't want to kind of give patients that false hope.
Yeah, it must be hard.
But it's trying to get patients to understand that it's not false hope, it's just trying to get things done, help you improve. And a lot of the time people don't want to do the physio either, and that's their choice. I don't begrudge them that at all. I just liked physical stuff, so I wanted to do it. And I could see long term it would benefit me, and it has benefited me massively doing all those things early on and really pushing it.
But it was really lovely as well, like when you're reading it, so like life affirming when you're reading the parallels between you saying like you've always played like rugby with your brothers, you've always been really competitive, and that you found in this thing like doing a physio and fighting that fight, that suddenly it was like a little light and you're like, I'm gonna do this.
Yeah, and I guess it was, there's one of the things that I could really kind of grab onto and say, all right, this is, the illnesses and stuff will happen, I can't stop that from happening, but if I'm in that physio room, I'm going to give it 100%. I'm only going to be there for an hour each day. Why not really push it? Mm. I can rest at other times, it's fine. But whilst I'm there, I'm going to push it. I'm going to do as many reps as I can, do all these things. No matter how small it is, I'm going to give it my all.
I think like that's such an amazing, like you saying before that when, because I'm a bit like this, and not so much more, but when I was younger, I was 100% like that. I thought if someone could do something better than me, I was like, well, they can just do it because I don't want to like be rejected or fail. And then you're saying now, like, I'm just going to do a thing. Honestly, when I was reading, I was writing notes on my phone. I was like, no, you're doing this week. You're not doing that. You're going to get that done. And I know that it's like, shouldn't take you having an accident for me to have this realization. But it is like so many people could take away from that. And your story is just so overwhelmingly life affirming. So when I am moaning or anyone's moaning about certain things, it's like, not like, what would Henry do? I mean, we could make that slogan. But it is really amazing because other people I just never seen a situation like this where I was so in awe of the way that you reacted to it. Like, it is fab. I'm not just trying to butt you up because I'm here. I mean, I'm a tanner bit, but it's fine.
No, but it's why we went for the title, the Little Big Things.
Yeah.
Because it's part of one of the things when I give talks, it's one of the sections of the talk. And when publisher thought we use that as a title, I thought, kind of, okay, we'll go for it. And then when I wrote the book, it just seemed so perfect for everything. Whether it be, I don't know, whether it be when I'm working out and there's little progresses that make you feel good, whether it's kind of I'm just sitting with my family, I'm thinking, I'm sitting with my family, it's fantastic, or out with my friends.
Mm.
And it's those little things that if you just think about them, suddenly you're like, oh, these are great. They are big things, they are.
Yeah.
They're not just little, they make you feel good. There's no point dwelling on all kind of negative stuff. It really just doesn't do anyone any good. Why not just find any positive you possibly can?
Exactly.
And I never had that mindset before the accident, and I guess it did take me the accident to realise these things. And so I don't begrudge people too much for thinking like that, but I just want people to think more about those things, because
yeah.
I've been on both sides of it big time, and I'm much further being on this side.
Yeah, but it's true, like I'd already in my life I had actually made an active decision to be less negative, like as I got older. I remember at uni I used to be that quite negative about things. Mm. And then since reading your book again, I do that, and it does change your complete outlook on life. And if you're in a place where your mental health allows you to make, because I know that some people, I guess, unfortunately, if your mental health doesn't allow you to, yeah. It can be a difficult thing to see the good in things. But if you are able to, it's amazing how much of a difference just that one small, instead of like seeing what you don't have, see what something gives you. Like you were saying, like you can just see what is added to your life rather than what's been taken away.
Yeah. And I have been given so much because of the accident, because of what's happened to me. So I'm kind of very grateful for that, and grateful for everything I have got and everything I'm still able to do. Like, why not, if I've got it, why not try and make the most of the things I'm able to do?
Mm.
So everyone else, just if you, whatever you can do, just do it.
Yeah.
And see what happens. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work, but giving it a try, and you can try something else, you've learned from it.
Yeah, and I think overall as well, especially the most important thing is clearly, like, irrespective of your disability, you're an incredible writer, an incredible orator, amazing painter, and all of those things are great. And I think what you're doing in terms of helping people to understand a disability from such a great perspective, and also just being open and honest enough, some of the stuff you write in the book is so raw and real, which is I'm sure is a massive task to kind of think, actually I'm sharing this. So I think a lot of people, well, if you haven't read the book, you need to read it, or I'll personally be annoyed. But yeah, it's been amazing to talk to you.
No, thank you for having me on.
Really enjoyed it. And Henry's actually wearing a jumper. It's one of your ones, isn't it? It says, it's a quote from the book, every day is a good day. Yeah. So yeah, I think that's a good thing to finish on. That's amazing. Thank you.
Thank you.